This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later in the show, we'll discuss the latest business news in Greater Cincinnati. But first, we'll get an update on the problems uncovered at Veterans Affairs medical centers across the country and here at the Cincinnati VA Medical Center during a Scripps Washington Bureau and WCPO investigation.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Phoenix and Alaska aren't the only places where the VA is falling short. In Cincinnati, doctors, nurses, and other employees have become so outraged by what they've been seeing, they're going public. More than three dozen whistleblowers have risked their jobs, talking to a team of reporters from WCPO-TV and the Scripps National Investigative Team. Mark Greenblatt is one of those reporters. He's been on the story for nearly a year, talking to hospital employees like Scott Landrum.
Hey, Scott.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are
good
you?
To see you, Mark. Good, good.
But the truth is, Scott wasn't so good. I'll let Mark take it from here.
And Mark Greenblatt is with us today, along with WCPO reporter Dan Monk, who's been working on the VA series with Mark and Aaron Kessler. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Mark and Dan, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for
having us. Good to be with you.
Mark, three dozen whistleblowers from the Cincinnati VA. What kind of problems are they pointing out to you? What are they telling you?
Well, they're telling us a lot, and first of all, of course, in investigative reporting, you normally get one or two or three whistleblowers, but when you get three dozen, you know there's some real issues. And to frame it for you, you know, there was a lot of complaints about services being cut in critical areas, and people, veterans who were in need of services like orthopedic total joint replacements, neurosurgeries, issues with the brain or spinal cord area, they had no doctors left to go see at the Cincinnati VA because of some controversial cuts. And when we really dug into why the cuts were happening, what we found was astounding and really quite disturbing.
Well, you had the VA reform program that came about because of the long waiting times that veterans are having to go through to get medical services. So we had the Veterans Choice Program come about. It was supposed to reduce those wait times that vets are experiencing across the country and give them easier access to health care outside the VA system. So what happened? Did something go awry with this?
Well, you know, it was in good faith here is what happened. Of course, it goes back to the scandal in Phoenix that became a national scandal where veterans were literally dying while they were on these wait lists trying to get an appointment to see the doctor. And so, you know, Congress came in and with very good intentions, they said, we're going to throw a bunch of money at this problem. We're going to literally take $10 billion and essentially keep it separate in a separate pot of cash from how they fund the VA as a federal agency. And they said, you know what, look, if the VA can't see a veteran quick enough in Cincinnati or elsewhere, then we're going to have this extra pot of cash. We're going to let them go see a private doctor just like you or I would see a doctor with a normal health insurance card. And it was supposed to provide them, you know, this key word being choice. They're supposed to have a choice between the VA or getting a little bit of quicker care if they couldn't get it at the VA. But instead what ended up happening was the way Congress set this up is that because this extra care was funded with a separate pot of cash, it in some ways created an incentive for hospital leadership in Cincinnati, we were told by many whistleblowers, to actually shut down certain key, very expensive programs in order to allow Congress to pay the bills instead of the Cincinnati VA. And so, you know, in short, what you had was if it was an expensive program, it was on the chopping block because it might end up making the budget look a little bit better in Cincinnati. Meanwhile, a veteran who was supposed to be able to get maybe supplementary care through this choice program would walk in the door at the Cincinnati VA looking for a specialist in let's say, a total hip replacement or a total shoulder replacement. And what they would find is that there were no more specialists left because they had cut the orthopedic surgeons in Cincinnati. And so they were forced into this so-called choice program, which, you know, in some cases, actually, we found would end up costing the taxpayer a whole lot more, although it would make the books look quite a bit more healthy locally at the Cincinnati VA.
Mark, Cincinnati wasn't the first medical center to come under scrutiny, so I'm wondering if you can give me an idea of the time frame here. How long from the first revelations about what was going on out in Phoenix, Arizona, before Cincinnati started getting looked at?
You know, you're really looking at a couple of years that went by because those revelations had to sort of come to pass, and it of course led to actually the resignation of the former VA Secretary Eric Shinseki. And so that scandal took a little bit of time to play out, and it took a little bit of time to play out to set up the choice program, and it was set up pretty fast. And really that led to some national challenges in the way that it was rolled out. And in Cincinnati, and we hear in other cities, these incentives that were created for some hospital administrators, they ended up benefiting in some cases the administrator more than the actual veteran.
Now, in that opening audio clip, we heard talk about Scott Landrum, who was one of the whistleblowers, that he's not having such a good day. And I'm wondering if you and Dan can talk to us about what happened with Scott Landrum. I mean, why wasn't he having a good day, and what's happened to him because of this?
Maybe I'll kick this off, and Dan, who was there right alongside with me, can follow up. This is, and it should be noted, Dan and I has been really working on this for really since last September. It's about a year ago now when we really started reporting this story jointly together. And you know, we showed up at Scott Landrum's house on a day of turmoil for him and his family. He had tried to do the right thing. He had tried to raise a red alarm internally without going public about dirty surgical instruments that he saw that were not getting cleaned up with inside the Cincinnati VA. We'd heard this from many whistleblowers, but Scott had seen it firsthand. His job was to be the surgical technician, the guy inside of the operating room who had to be an office manager of sorts of the operating room. He had to decide, okay, we have the right instruments, they're all clean, and they're all sterile. And then he would actually personally hand us, you know, an allegedly sterile knife to the surgeon to cut with. Well, he kept seeing problems, sterility problems, that he kept raising as issues inside the VA, and he was really getting nowhere. And so what happened with Scott was that after the VA conducted an investigation internally, they came out and very publicly said, hey, we can't find anything to allegations that are coming from Scott Landrum or from other people who publicly talked out about these concerns. And eventually, WCPO in Cincinnati and the Scripps Washington Bureau held a town hall where the now acting network director of the region came in and essentially said, yeah, so far we can't find anything. And it upset Scott so much that he stood up in this public forum in April and said, what do you mean you can't find any problems? I've been filing reports for a long time. What's been happening to those reports that I filed? And he took a risk because he publicly stood up in a public forum and took on a powerful administrator with the VA. And he was promised that night that everything would be fine, and that he'd be listened to, and that the VA would take his concerns very seriously, and they'd look into them. Well, 2 days after he stood up very courageously and very publicly in that forum, the VA did get back to him, and what they said to him was that they intended to fire him. And it was for another reason, they said to him. But from his perspective, this couldn't have been more clear. And other whistleblowers were quite concerned that this was a clear sort of shot across the bow to the dozens of whistleblowers who spoke to us or anybody else who might want to speak out to any news reporter across the country, that if you speak out, the message that they received was that the VA would come after you. And so Scott, when we walked into his house on that day, had been served with notice that he was going to be fired and was fighting it and was having to hire an attorney for thousands of dollars out of his own pocket to try to fight this. And Dan, I don't know your thoughts on it, but, he seemed to be handling it on its face well that day to me, but underlying it all, this was a guy fighting for his family, right?
Yeah, he was clearly stressed on the day that we were at his house, as was his wife, and it was you could tell that it was weighing on him. The other thing that I thought was interesting about that whole town hall experience was I really didn't know what to expect when we decided to do this town hall. One reason we did it was because veterans were telling us that the VA had stopped doing town halls, and we actually went to an event during our reporting process that we thought was going to be a town hall event, and it was a bunch of VA employees sitting around at tables. It was kind of like a networking session. It wasn't a forum where veterans were, you know, actually allowed to talk about the problems they're encountering at the VA. We wanted to hear what veterans had to say. Very few veterans showed up because it wasn't the kind of format that they wanted. So after all of these stories broke, there was an immediate reaction from the VA with the reassignment of the chief of staff and the resignation of the network director, the guy who oversaw the Cincinnati Hospital and other hospitals in Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan. But they kept saying in press releases and in statements, as we asked, you know, what's the investigation, what's the status of the investigation, that they were finding no problems with patient care, and that did not jibe with what we had heard.
No, you kept digging, obviously, yeah, and found that wasn't the case, right?
Right. And so when Scott raised his hand at that night, I think he was one of two, maybe three people who raised the same issue in that town hall meeting, and that obviously cued us to what our next story was going to be about.
Yeah, Mark. Go right ahead.
I was just going to add to this. You know, sort of rewinding and going behind the scenes of the investigation. You know, before we printed or aired anything on this, it really was a telling moment where, when Dan and I walked into that room that he was talking about, it's supposed to be this town hall, and here I was thinking, flying in from D.C., thinking, okay, I'm going to actually get to meet some veterans who are going to get up and, you know, complain about something or other, and I'll get to listen, and Dan will get to listen, and get a feel for the temperature for, you know, what's going on from the veterans' perspective. We'd heard from the internal employees. And I was sort of shocked, you know, walking in the hall, and what I realized was that they had, the VA had essentially taken a voice away from veterans. They had sort of stopped listening in a way, because by stopping a traditional town hall forum, they made it so that anybody who had anything to say or to suggest for an opportunity for improvement no longer could really do that publicly. They lost their public voice. And so, you know, it was only until that town hall forum that we put on CPO and the Washington Bureau here for Scripps, that their voice was given back, and it was almost as if the moment that they had their public voice back, it allowed people like Scott Landrum to finally speak out.
We will continue our conversation, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're wrapping up the fall fund drive in just a matter of hours, and we're counting on you to help us wrap it up successfully. Make that phone call to 513-419-7155, or you can make a contribution online at either wvxu.org or wmub.org. And thank you so much for your support. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. My guest this afternoon with an update on the problems uncovered at Veterans Affairs medical centers across the country and here at the Cincinnati VA Medical Center, with EW Scripps Senior National Investigative Correspondent Mark Greenblatt, and Nine on Your Side, WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk. The Scripps Washington Bureau and WCPO have been working on a joint investigative series about the VA. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Mark, after that preliminary investigation, how long was there an administrative shakeup at some point? How long afterward did that occur?
Yeah, there was, and we had found, in addition to all these other problems that we've been talking about here this hour, we had dug up that the acting chief of staff in Cincinnati at the VA there had been prescribing opioids, controlled substances, for the network director's wife. And we had found out that she did not have a license to be doing this privately, prescribing controlled substances. And it became a big problem. The VA, within a couple of weeks of when we brought this to their attention, put out a news release saying that we had that they had found and substantiated charges of wrongdoing, and so they removed this acting chief of staff, a woman by the name of Dr. Barbara Tomek, took away her medical privileges and reassigned her to the basement to work a paperwork job, and they told the network director, a guy by the name of Jack Hetrick, that he was going to be fired. So he sort of slips into retirement instead and doesn't go through the motions on that. But it was that happened within a couple of weeks. Now, the issues that we are also talking about this hour and have been continuing to look into for the better part of a year are that while they removed them from power over this prescription issue, the VA had sort of put its head in the sand and said, you know, but we couldn't find a thing related to any of the quality care issues that three dozen insiders were talking about and providing documents to us about. And so it was after that moment that they came out very quickly and said, yes, we found problems about the prescriptions and the medical care, but we can't find anything over here. Nothing to see here, folks. Don't look here. You know, we've solved the problem by removing these two people. You know, the problem was that the VA had not addressed the underlying issues that caused three dozen people to approach Congress, to approach people on the VA's internal watchdog teams, and eventually to approach the media. And so we've continued to report since then.
And as I understand it, Dr. Temmick has actually become a whistleblower herself. Right, Dan?
That's right, yeah. She has raised allegations that the University of Cincinnati exerts too much influence over the operation of the Cincinnati VA, and she has also alleged that that UC doctors have been paid for hours that they didn't actually work at the VA. And so the VA is going to be looking into these claims in October with a board of inquiry that's going to start, I believe the latest date is October 3rd when it starts. And so the idea is that Temmick will sort of have her day in court, I guess, before this panel. And all of the people that she names as, you know, offenders in her whistleblower complaint, the way I understand it is that they're going to have the opportunity to speak as well. And I think it's also an opportunity for this investigative panel to ask Dr. Temmick some questions. So my understanding from Glenn Cossey, who's the medical center director, was that all whistleblowers are invited to participate in this process. And the VA has also put out a statement saying the main focus of it will be Dr. Temmick's allegations relating to the University of Cincinnati.
Yeah, they were the main leadership changes. Have there been other leadership changes as well, Dan?
I think there have been five since February, and there's about to be a sixth. Glenn Cossey, who's the medical center director, was appointed on an interim basis over the summer to replace John Gennaro, and he is going to be going back to Dayton, and we've heard that they have found—
Of course, all this is administrative. This is not because of any suspected wrongdoing or anything.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Yeah, they all flow from the same decision. You know, they reassigned the chief of staff, so they had to replace the chief of staff, and then later reassigned the medical center director without actually explaining why he was leaving. He went to a smaller hospital in Pennsylvania, Gennaro did, and they brought in Glenn Cossey, who has some experience handling these kinds of controversies in Dayton, and I believe he was in Phoenix for a period of time as well.
Mark, have these leadership changes have they helped? Are there improvements coming to the Cincinnati VA that you've seen?
Well, look, you know, I mean, our measurement is from talking to a lot of the folks who are still working there, and there's no doubt that there are a lot of people who are saying that morale has gone up since some of these changes have come in, and they've brought in this interim director who. The folks that I'm talking to, you know, he's getting very good remarks, Glenn Cossey. They're saying that he's listening to them, and that's a big change for them. Now, I think that one of the key things will be, you know, one of the key tests long-term for the institution once he leaves, which is very soon, as Dan notes, will be, are they actually acting? Is it lip service that they're paying to these people on the inside, or are they actually listening to what they're saying, and are they taking corrective measures to fix the problem, or will they continue to say there's no problems here, nothing to see? So that's one thing to measure. And you know, just sort of piggybacking off of your conversation here a second ago and some of Dan's comments, one of the most fascinating things that's happening right now in real time is this panel that's going to be listening to Dr. Barbara Temmick's own whistleblower complaints. Just to give you a little bit of a frame of a timeline here, so we come out with our investigation. She has substantiated charges held up against her and is sort of removed from the role of acting chief of staff, voluntarily actually turns in her registration with the DEA, which allows her to prescribe any kind of controlled substance. And it was after all of that that she then goes public through an attorney and files a whistleblower complaint, sort of raising a whole lot of allegations about a lot of people that you noted a little bit ago. And, you know, just very transparently as reporters, Dan and I have had some interaction with her attorney, very much inviting Dr. Tomek to sort of come to the table and provide a lot of documentation that might substantiate some of these charges. And we've certainly afforded her an opportunity to sit with us for an interview. And, you know, I don't think it's, I think one of the more interesting parts about this, because we truly do wish to hear from her and to evaluate these claims, her attorney came back to us and said, well, we'll consider letting her sit for an interview with you if you hand over to us a document that had all of these signatures of all of the confidential whistleblowers that the attorney was asking we turn over, sort of something that would list our confidential sources. And, you know, we declined that, but we're still waiting to see documentation, at least directly from Dr. Tomek, to substantiate some of what she said in her whistleblower complaint. But if she doesn't want to talk to us, she certainly has the opportunity to provide this information to this government board. And I think that's a great forum. And so I think we're all in real time waiting to see, well, what will come from that.
Nelson in Clifton joins us. And Nelson, good afternoon.
Hi. Yeah. I think we should maybe go back into where this began. We have a political party which has sworn that this is what they were going to do, to cut everything, and they're very proud of it. And I think we should be very wary of any whistleblowing right now, since the last midterms, things have changed all over this country and the world regarding that takeover by a political party which has sworn.
Nelson, go ahead and
everything.
Give us your question, please.
Can you please trace it back and not call it Congress, but call which political party has been behind this? They swore that they were going to infiltrate all of our democratically established institutions with saboteurs, and
let's let them go ahead and answer. Okay, thanks, Nelson.
Well, Choice was a Republican.
John McCain's
led,
idea, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Right. Yeah. It was a Republican-led initiative. And, you know, like Mark said earlier, I think the people in Congress who wanted, who proposed this, did it in a well-meaning fashion. And I think the VA, you know, if you believe everything that they've said and Bob McDonald has said, they tried to implement it in a well-meaning fashion. And, you know, they had a lot of it is a program, a $10 billion program that they were required to implement. I think it was in 90 days. Is that right, Mark? It was they weren't given much time to set up an infrastructure for this. It had a lot of unintended consequences. How much of that was because of the time frame that the Republicans imposed? How much of that was because the VA didn't want to cede control of these programs? I mean, if you look at the latest proposals from the VA, what they want is control of this pot of money. And, you know, they want to be able to take this pot that, you know, is restricted currently, and they want to be able to spend it how they see fit. So, you know, there was this tug of war between Congress and the VA, each of them, I think, with motivations that were on the right side. They both, I think, were trying to help veterans, help solve a problem that that was clearly detrimental to the care of veterans. And, you know, the end result was something that was less than satisfactory, probably for both sides.
Mark, any thoughts?
Yeah, Dan, I mean, and I think just sort of piggybacking off, it was an extraordinarily fast and ambitious plan to deploy this major program in such a short period of time, especially for an institution agency that has had so many sort of organizational problems. One thing that, you know, we haven't really talked a lot about, but I find fascinating as a reporter looking at institutions and agencies, is that there's this organization, the investigative arm of Congress. It's called the GAO. And every year they come up with something called a high-risk list, where they sort of identify the agencies in the federal government that have the worst problems, where they're the highest risk of fraud, waste, and abuse. And the VA has been on this list year after year after year after year. You know, and so what Congress really did here was they trusted an agency that, on one hand, their own investigators are saying is really one of the least trustworthy agencies that exist, and it's had a long track record of that. And they said, you guys figure this out, how to deploy it in 90 days, a short period of time, and so I'll leave it to you to decide how smart that decision was.
Mark, have there been efforts to reform the reform? I mean, to change the way Veterans Choice works so that you can avoid the problems that have occurred because of it?
Oh, yeah. And there have been real changes, you know, that have been put in place. I think that the VA recognizes outwardly in congressional hearings that that this has not been rolled out well. They've been they've admitted that some of the private contractors that they've hired to try to manage the program have sort of fallen flat. And they've said, you know, on up to the secretary of the VA, they've testified publicly that there are problems and that they're trying to fix them. And in many cases, there have been reforms put in place. So I do think you'll see sort of a smoothing out where it's not going to be as problematic as it has been, as some of these reforms get put in place. But, you know, it still was a program that was set up very quickly, and the question is with how much thought and how much new legislation might have to go behind it to try to fix some of the things that were sort of rushed through. Those are some of the questions that I think remain outstanding.
You've been investigating for a year or so. Where do you head from here? What's next in this?
What do you think, Dan?
Well, there's a lot to this story, isn't there?
Yeah, well, I still want to know, are the veterans getting good care? We've heard from more than 50 veterans now raising various complaints relating to the patient care they've received in Clifton and in other locations. Also, disability benefit rulings and things like that. A lot of veterans don't feel like they've been treated fairly by the VA. And I make a habit now of every time I see somebody who I think is a veteran asking them how their care goes, and I would say it's about half and half. If you randomly approach a veteran, you ask them whether they've encountered the VA, how did their care go, and it's about half and half. Now, that is not what the VA keeps saying, that their data is that, 90-plus percent of veterans are satisfied, the wait times are going down. They have data points to support, every argument they make. And but if you just randomly ask veterans—
You still got a lot of questions.
I do. Yeah.
Yeah.
So— What about you, Mark? What are we working on next?
Put him on the spot now.
I don't mind publicly telling you one thing and telling the audience one thing. I've been telling the VA, if you don't hurry up on this one item, I might talk about this publicly. You know, we have filed Freedom Information Act requests where we've asked for some correspondence. And we'd like to know some correspondence between the VA and some outside entities on some of the issues that we're talking about. And we filed those requests back in March. They have identified the documents. They've blacked out the areas that need to be blacked out. And yet they have not turned them over to us to share with the public. And I am very intrigued to see what's inside of those letters and emails and documents. And we've been doing our best to convince them it'd be a good idea to try to, for the sake of how important this story has been to the Cincinnati community, to just be transparent. And, perhaps they will soon release something that we can give you an update on that front. And, on another front, that's sort of maybe looking at backwards communications. But looking forward, I think that it's fair to say that, the entire Scripps Corporation, the reason why Dan and I are talking here, it's really sort of a rare thing to team up a investigative team locally in Cincinnati and an investigative team out of D.C. and just sort of combine forces and thoughts and skills and just different paradigms. We've given a great investment into this story because, the Scripps is, of course, headquartered in Cincinnati and has made such an investment in the community. And it's fair to say that we're going to be here on this story for a long time to come. And so what I'd like to do is to not just say just because there are new faces that are taking over in leadership positions at the Cincinnati VA, to not let that be the end of the story, but to say that we are going to be there, we are going to be checking up, and we are going to see how do these new people do? Do they listen to their own employees? Do they listen to the veterans? Do they hold these town hall meetings in a real way where it's sort of out for the public to hear what voices have challenges that they want to bring out publicly? So these are what we'll continue to measure, and we'll continue to watch, and we're not going away at any time.
Mark and Dan, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
AW Scripps Senior National Investigative Correspondent Mark Greenblatt and Nine on Your Side WCPO.com Business Reporter Dan Monk. You can find links to the Scripps Washington Bureau WCPO Insider Series on the VA by Mark Greenblatt, Dan Monk, and Aaron Kessler, and also to the Center for Investigative Reporting's Reveal podcast on the VA at WVXU.org. Dan's going to join us in the next part of the show as we review the latest business news from around Cincinnati. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. These are the last few hours of the fall fund drive, and as Ken was saying, now's the time to call 513-419-7155. Last day of the fund drive is always the busiest, so get your call in right now while you're thinking about it, 513-419-7155, or you can give online at wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. It's our weekly review of the news, and we're taking a look at the latest business news in Greater Cincinnati with WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk and Cincinnati Inquirer business reporter Alex Coolidge. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Alex, thanks for joining us. Dan, good to see you again here.
Mm-hmm.
Dan,
for having me.
Let's start off by talking about what's going on with Macy's a lot.
Yeah.
They've been on a program called Shrink to Grow, I believe it is, where they're closing down stores. How many stores are we talking about at this point?
100 stores. They announced when their earnings came out in August that they're going to close about 100 stores, probably most of them by the end of the year. And the idea is that they're going to get rid of stores that aren't performing as well and then concentrate on their top-performing stores, some 150, 180 stores, where they feel like they have the best potential to grow.
Any idea if any of the Cincinnati area stores are going to be part of this?
A lot of people think so. I mean, they've said they're going to close about 15% of the Macy's store stock. So that's roughly one out of six. There are six Macy's stores here. So, you know, that's one rationale. And then, Alex, you wrote about a study that said the Midwestern markets were weaker for Macy's as well. Is that right?
Yeah, there was a study that showed it actually drilled down to a select group of metropolitan areas, and the Cincinnati area is down about 7.5%. So that's not encouraging.
Their market share is down 7.5% in the Cincinnati metro area.
Right, at the expense of Nordstrom and Dillard's have actually climbed in the same time period, which was the last fiscal year, I think.
So, Dan, you wrote at WCPO.com that Macy's CEO, Terry Lundgren, was rather disappointed because they found out one of his favorite stores was on that list of potentials to be closed.
Yeah, apparently he loved the men's store in San Francisco, and he said that their real estate vice president, Doug Sessler, came to him one day and said, we need to think about closing this store, and he said he had an emotional breakdown about it. Really made me sad. I kind of felt sorry for the guy, but I think he'll find a new place to shop.
When are they expecting to? You said toward the end of the year we'll know that final list of the 100 stores?
Yeah. My expectation is that they'll announce it sometime before the holidays sales start so that people will have a chance to shop there one last time if they have a devotion to a particular Macy's store. But I'm not sure if every one of the 100 stores is actually going to close by the end of the year. They may take some time to close out leases. And, they may not be able to close 100 of them right away, right after the holidays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because we're going into a period, Alex, where Macy's is hiring a lot of people for the holidays. I think it's, what, 83,000?
Yeah, that's about right. They're bulking up for the critical Christmas holiday season. They do this every year. 83,000 is about level with last year, and it needs to do well. They've Macy's stock has been in the doghouse for like the last year and a half. At the start of calendar year 2015, Macy's executives sort of boldly said, you know, we're entering a new period where we're really going to focus on growing the top line, growing sales, growing revenues. After years of very carefully and very shrewdly managing profits and becoming very profitable, but then they didn't deliver. And Wall Street gave them a pass for about 6 months, and the stock actually hit an all-time high in July of 2015. And since then,
they said we're through waiting, and it's been
lost half their value. Yeah. And you know, this is why they've come under tremendous pressure by hedge funds. To one hedge fund manager was very loudly suggesting publicly, "Hey, why don't you chop the company in two? One, become a real estate company that, like, just is a landlord, and then become another company that's the retailer. And wouldn't that be great? You'd free up all this money, and everybody would be happy." Macy's feels that that's really kind of hard to do because some sites are more valuable than others, and some are so ridiculously valuable. How do you value the Herald Square store, which has been owned by Macy's for, you know, nearly a century? You know, how do you get a completely accurate read on that? It's so they've resisted that, but this is in part why they're chopping stores. They're responding to shareholder pressure. What would relieve the pressure would be a good holiday season.
Yeah, and part of the Shrink to Grow program too, they're looking at some different types of stores too to try to boost sales. I think you wrote about a prototype store they have up in Columbus. Mm-hmm. And tell us about that. I mean, what is the store going to be like?
Well, it'll be a lot like, you know, the Macy's stores you're familiar with, only with more experiences, more events, possibly some restaurant food on our tour of that store in Columbus, the Easton store. There is a smoothie place. They have a big athletic leisure wear section. Part of that is they have yoga classes, weekly and over the summer months.
So they're adding in attractions to try to draw customers in.
Okay. Yeah. Terry Lundgren has talked about this on multiple occasions. I covered the National Retail Federation event in January of this year. And he talked about wanting more experiences in their store. Things like, makeup artists who come in and they will they'll give you a demonstration on how to do your makeup in certain styles. They'll have yoga classes in stores. They'll have some of their celebrity endorsers, you know, the people like Thalia who they have a clothing line. She might make an appearance in the New York store, for example. So they are looking for basically anything they can do to bring more people in the door, because once they're there, they're assuming they're going to buy something.
Alex, what do you think? How likely is this going to help boost their sales?
Well, it's part of a broader move by all retailers. Yeah. Kroger is doing the same thing, mm-hmm, with their supermarkets. All the speculation around what they might end up doing with the Mariano's chain. And Kroger bought out Roundy's late last year. The crown jewel of that acquisition was this really very shopper-resonant upscale retailer in urban Chicago. And part of the appeal of Mariano's in Chicago is it's very experiential. I've actually been to one of the stores, went there last year, and it's the newest one they had at the time was in Lincoln Park, and it was actually a two-decker one. The upper floor was just your traditional supermarket, cornflakes, you know, milk, eggs, whatever. But then on the ground floor of that same store, they had, rather than your typical supermarket where you put a ring of, you know, the delicatessen and the bakery shop, they clustered it all together and put it down on the ground floor, and then they threw in some other sort of she attractions, like a wine bar and an oyster bar, and they had a grand piano player, somebody playing Stairway to Heaven down there. And the whole point.
Sounds like they're trying to be everything to everybody.
Well, the whole point.
Stairway to Gouda.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the whole point. The whole point is you create sort of a destination,
right,
to go to, and it's not just this cold transaction of, oh, I got to buy milk and cornflakes. It's like, oh, you know what? I got to buy cornflakes and milk, but maybe I'll stop for a beer at the
Yoga class.
or get a yoga class and then have a beer.
Well, the underlying issue for both of them and all retailers is that it's easy to get something over the internet. You have a point and a click and you've bought this week's groceries or you've bought this week's outfit. You know what I mean? So I think that's right. Kroger and Macy's.
If you're brick and mortar, you've got to do some things to keep up.
Yeah, they're trying to keep their real estate relevant. And, you know, I don't think it's a – what is it? I think it's 90% of retail sales in department stores is still brick and mortar. Is that right?
Somewhere thereabouts.
It's a large majority of sales that still happen in the real estate. So they're just trying to make sure that they can, you know, maintain that as Amazon grows or other online sites become more prevalent.
Yeah, speaking of Kroger, Alex, there's been talk about Kroger opening a new downtown grocery. And the Inquirer got some information this week, got an update on this, the location.
At the southeast corner of Walnut and Central Avenue. Is the site in question. Kroger's not talking about it, but the parties involved in the negotiations or some of the folks, I got to be careful about how I say this, have basically said that there's very serious discussion of a potential development there.
So Kroger's not confirmed any of this?
No, okay. No.
Except that they want to have a downtown store.
Yeah, exactly.
They've said that for
and that's
a couple
the thing.
Of years.
They're a little gun shy about talking about it before a deal is signed because they've been sort of in similar discussions numerous times. And, you know, anything can go wrong at the last minute. Downtown urban locations are very tricky because you want to have a location that's close to a population that can, you know, a nearby cluster of people either going to work or living to come to your store and then, you know, drive sales. But by that very nature, that land is also going to be more expensive. So it's a balancing act between how much store you can afford to build, and can you build one big enough to sort of attract the customers you need to make it a success?
Yeah, so. There have been a lot of efforts, rumors, a lot of talk about putting in a downtown grocery store. So you think what Kroger has going is pretty substantial?
The parties are very encouraged, but you know, that's about as specific as it gets.
Yeah.
They seriously looked at the 8451 site for a and Kroger officials have confirmed they considered putting a supermarket there, but at the end of the day, they couldn't make the economics work, so they did not.
Now, Dan, Kroger, in the meantime, they've been dealing with a problem of deflation, mm-hmm. falling prices. What? Tell us about that.
Well, they updated shareholders at their last earnings call that profits will be down this year. They downwardly adjusted their expectations, I guess. And the reason they cited was deflation. Retailers or grocers around the country are dealing with this now of, falling prices in eggs and beef and basically every place but produce and pharmacy, I think is what Kroger said in their last call. And so one of the things that's kind of interesting about it is that Kroger has said in these calls that if you ask their customers, you know, consumers still feel like they're paying more at the grocery store, but retailers are really being damaged by this, or they're being they're having to cut costs and be very mindful of their profit situation because prices are falling faster than people expected them to. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, particularly in a market like Cincinnati, where Kroger has a dominant market share. You've got new competitors coming in like Aldi and Amazon selling online groceries. Will that put more price pressure on Kroger, or will the loyalty they've, accumulated over the years with their, shopper cards and their market knowledge, will they be able to withstand this price competition that's inevitable?
So when investors look at this deflationary situation that Kroger is facing, how concerned are they about it?
Well, the stock price has been down over the last several weeks. So, yeah, I'd say they're quite concerned about it.
Real quickly, Alex, let's talk about P&G has had some it's been divesting itself out of its beauty care business. And what's the latest on this?
Well, actually, there was a development this morning. They just announced P&G is basically carving out 41 non-core beauty brands, and they're going to automatically be merged with a beauty company in New York called Coty, which makes Rimmel makeup, and they also make Calvin Klein and a whole bunch of other perfumes on a license basis. What happened this morning is they announced the results of their tender offer, and basically they had six times as many people as they needed to say, hey, I'll turn in my P&G shares.
For Coty shares.
In exchange for shares in an entity that will immediately be merged with Coty, but not direct Coty shares yet. But it's effectively so, yeah.
But P&G says by doing this, we'll be a leaner company.
Meaner company. Now we can focus on our core brands, and hopefully we'll grow a little faster as a result. That's the theory. Now it just has to work.
Dan and Alex, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk and Cincinnati Inquirer business reporter Alex Coolidge. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. In his latest book, journalist Rick Pender shares his list of 100 things to do in Cincinnati before you die. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll talk with Rick about the culture, history, and experiences that define our region, and we'd like to hear what would be on your list. We'll also get a preview of Photo Focus 2016, and in Focus on Technology, the Cincinnati Bell Connector's smart cameras. That's Cincinnati Edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.